Well, I'm a mathematician, and I like to address things from a position of a skeptic on anything mathematical or scientific. They need to see what they have to say. How many of you, when you're reading a book, will look at one-star reviews first? Anybody? Am I the only one? The point is that by looking at people's objections, you can find out their viewpoint, whether it's a valid viewpoint. And I usually find out the one-star reviews are people that haven't even read the book. But the ones that do, very often will that are respectable, will actually show me some insight in what's really in the book that you won't find otherwise. So this, to start off this topic, even though I've studied it from a pro-Stroud viewpoint for many years, I'm going to start it from the viewpoint of the anti-Stroud viewpoint. As a mathematician says, the relics of the Christ by the leading skeptic, Joe Nickell, and we'll see if his arguments are valid. From a mathematical standpoint, you use arguments of what the implications are, and you see if that holds the water, and then it shows your premise. Your premise follows your conclusions. The premise, if the Stroud is genuine, should have certain conclusions. Same thing if it's false. So it should have some conclusions. So we'll address that from a mathematical viewpoint, but no math, no arithmetic here, but just simply logic. So we're addressing this as a viewpoint. So I'm going to cover many topics today. So one of the topics will be examine the Stroud itself and why it would be considered to be at least significant, because there are many images of Christ. Why would the Stroud be anything different? Somebody could fake, like he said, the relics of the Christ. There are many relics out there. Why is this not just one like that, just something not to be taken seriously? But surprisingly, what happened in 1898 with Secundo Pio, they found out there was an image of the photograph that looked more real in the negative than it did in the positive. So it's all of a sudden, the Stroud takes a meaning, the real Stroud of Turin takes a meaning more so than all these other Stroud copies and things that are been floating around for many years, and all the other relics. It stands out as unique. As they studied in 1978, they discovered properties from ultraviolet radiation, all these different types of characteristics. They found out there was a lot more to this characteristic than a painting would ever have. The skeptics, Walter McCrone, would say it was just a painted image because I found some iron on it. Well, so iron has in the pigment would indicate there might be some pigment on there. So that was considered as a possibility. He was the only one that looked at that. But by and large, half the 1978 investigators, all PhDs or scientists, were not believers in the Stroud. They were just looking at it to see why is it's got this image in there and where's it from. Max Fry found out there is pollen on there, and we'll see some more elements about how you can track the pollen down where it came from. They found that there was a fabric analysis. Was the fabric that's made, the 3-in-1 herringbone twill, is it symptomatic of first century Jerusalem, or is it more symptomatic of Europe? Dirt on the Stroud, where does it come from? This level of detail has been unprecedented as far as any scientific investigation. But what is the most interesting thing about it? I've only thought about it in the last week or two. Why is it there not a single mention in any archaeology textbook anywhere, Christian or otherwise? It's just like a fringe topic. But it's certainly very interesting from just an archaeology standpoint, even though it's unprovenance, that we don't know exactly where it came from. We'll discuss that. The next thing was that we discussed with the Jewish burial practices. We learned a lot about the Jewish burial practices and the Roman crucifixion just from looking at the Stroud and then saying, well, is this really, really reliable? Then going looking at the actual evidences and finding, yes, it contradicts most of what we thought we knew about burial practices or Roman crucifixion. It actually matches very well what it really is. And how is a forger going to know this? Stroud history. We only know about the Stroud history from the 1355. We know for sure where it's been since then. But before it, maybe it's it follows this mythical cloth called the Mandylion in Constantinople or in the city of Edessa, we'll talk about. So when Jesus was crucified, somewhere around, we think, probably 33, some people think earlier, unknown what happened in the period of time. But this story is related to it. We're not going to go into all that. And 1550, it reemerges. And then 944, gone to Constantinople. We'll discuss how in 1204, it was disappeared from Constantinople, was taken by knights to probably parts unknown, and then reemerged by one of the knights in 1355. And we know where it is since then. So it does have a possible history related to it. The skeptics and the Bible scholars think that it may be a 14th century fraud. Well, certainly we'll see that when we get to the carbon dating analysis. In my attitude, I never really understood how they could think of this artist fraud because they didn't know the details. Sort of like people being skeptical from that viewpoint, it's not a valid viewpoint because of the difficulty in forging it, something like that complexity. We'll discuss the art history. This is fairly new find, 1195, artwork from a manuscript in Hungary, which is definitively dated to 1195, matches the shroud almost in very many, many cases, 11 cases. Image-forming mechanism, that's the weakest part of the shroud, claimed to be genuine, is that no one really has a good idea how it could be formed. I'm not the least of myself, but we can establish with high confidence it was not painted, and that finally, we'll say it agrees with the Bible, even though this Bible scholars have debated that. We'll discuss the Bible. It's got blood on it, AB-type blood. It's got art traces that we'll discuss, Roman crucifixion, first century fabric, Middle East pollen and dirt. We'll discuss all those issues. A lot of things to cover here. One of the things that I like about it, my favorite quote from Mark Twain, which isn't from Mark Twain, but I always thought it was, the trouble of this world is not that people know too little, but it's so many things they know that ain't so. I think that it's one of the things that astonished me, and one of the things I like looking at critics, even in the Bible, is I learn things from discussing, looking at the other point of view. So the original quote is actually from somebody named Artemus Wade. I've never heard of him. But here's the real images that are related to it. I try not to focus on images very much. Like the people that are so-called shroudies focus on the image and tend to think of this is a real image of Christ. Well, the point is that no one knows what anything's looking for. To call it an image of Christ is something that's not helpful for this viewpoint. It's an archaeological relic that we're looking at to see what we can learn from it. This photographic image in 1898 with Secundo Pio, you notice that the top image, to their astonishment, looked like a real photograph as opposed to the original bottom. And it was discussed that why is this like this? I mean, if an artist was going to forge it, why on earth would they ever make something into a negative where the image was like that? In 1978, they found out that it has three-dimensional properties that actually it's correlated to the distance of the fabric from the body. The only thing I'm going to call your notice to is in the bottom left here, because this will come up very, this is new research. The bottom left, you'll find these holes. They call them poker holes, and these poker holes up in here. These holes appear in one of the manuscripts from 1195, and one is the most, I'd say, the highest secure attributions where you can say that, in fact, this shroud probably existed in 1195. Look at the hands here. You can see better in the negative. This is left on the right, and the hole in the wrist is on the left hand. Well, that's the copy. The original would have been right hand over the left with the right hand having the hole in it, again on the wrist, which is very against all art up to that time. More detail backing, but I don't want to call you this, get a very busy chart. I just wanted to see that the type of things that you'll find that you would never notice here, that the image is now reversed, so the head is on the bottom, pardon me, that's the way the image came out, is the puncture marks are on the top and side of the head, indicating that this artist, if you want to call it that, or original, indicates the body, the cap, it was a cap on the head, not just a crown of thorns, it would be a cap of thorns. Water strains from the pollution. There's also something very unusual. There's 120 of these abrasion marks, I'll show you in detail, that look like they're little dumbbells on the back of the, mostly in the back and the sides, all over the legs of the body, the scourge marks. The burn holes, I won't get into it very much at all, but just simply those two things, the abrasion of the shoulders, the back of the shoulders, which again, who would ever think of these things? All these things that are formed in here, all these images, even though this is an image that's highly contrasted, it's in a computer. Can you adjust the contrast? You know how to do that? Get more contrast? You would never see this image. You go up to look right next to it, you won't see anything. You get up right next to it, the image just disappears. An artist making this type of image would be impossible because you wouldn't be able to see the image. It's only in the topmost fibers of the fabric. And again, this is a highly contrast change. But in 1988, remember the day? I remember it very well. Announced the shroud is a fake. That's a time of rejoicing among the skeptics and us a little depressed about those us that think that this is more than simply a fake. This is no way that this can be a fake. But nevertheless, the pronouncement has come. You have to live with it, get a life. And I love the quote from him, from Hall and Mitchell and Tite. He said, Professor Edward Tedry Hall has bluntly told the British Museum press conference, there was a multi-million pound business in making forgeries during the 14th century. Someone just got a bit of linen, faked it, and flogged it. Guess what? He never even looked at a shroud. He had no idea what it would take to make a shroud image like that. So the interesting thing about it, and this is fairly new, you won't find this anywhere else, is that the British Museum, when it was trying to have a neutral test, you know how carbon-14 dating is done? They have the sample you want to do and a control sample. They have actually three control samples from recent, middle, and then old. So they want to have a variety of data. But they couldn't find a 3-in-1 herringbone linen from the Middle Ages to test. That's strange. Somebody is going to fake the shroud, is going to create a fabric that's so rare that it would cost a ransom to find something of that kind, to find it somewhere in the Middle East. So I think that's very significant. And yet, somehow, this is obscured. They didn't bother to mention this in their press release. The shroud itself, what is it like? It shows it like a photo negative, exhaustive testing of the shroud. And again, the skeptics keep saying, well, this is just simply believers trying to prove this. Well, and the answer is no. Very few of them were, only a few of them were Catholics. Few of them were, maybe half of them perhaps had Christian backgrounds, but they certainly were not shroudies by any standpoint trying to prove the validity. They were scientists trying to see what is this object and what can we tell you about it. In 1988, like I said, the shroud produced a date of the 1290s roughly, and it certainly was a fiasco. Why? Because the original protocol, you understand protocol means the way you're supposed to be doing a testing, is that you do 7 samples. I'm a mathematician. If you want to get an average or get an idea, you want to have a variety of samples and from different parts of the shroud. To get one little size part of it that's maybe not representative and get only 3 samples, well, what kind of average is that? What kind of math statistics are going to do in that? What they didn't tell you in the result of that, there was so much difference in the 3 dates. They said it was similar, but there's so much difference in the data, like 1,300 years, I mean, not 330 years, that you can tell that it was not a good statistics. If the 2 of them were valid, no, all 3 were all over the map in that 130-year range. So in 2002, a scholar who was not even a doubter of the carbon-14 dating, Ray Raymond, pointed out that that they had possibility of a mixture. You don't understand, you can repair a shroud fabric and you can have parts that more recent fabric woven in with it. I had no idea it was possible. And in fact, it takes linen experts to understand how you can reweave something that unless a very good expert, has difficulty telling that it's been rewoven to that to show that. So it's possible that that could have been an explanation of the carbon-14. We don't know that, but we do know, and Ray showed that there was a vanillin test. What is vanillin? When linen ages, it loses this little chemical we call vanillin that is produced by linen originally, the flax, and then as a period of time goes, it basically evaporates, it decays. So the age of 2,000 years old fabric should have no detectable vanillin in, and that's in fact the case with most of the shroud. It has no detectable vanillin on it, and yet in that repair, we think it's a possibly repair fabric. We know in the repair fabric, which was repaired in after one of the fires, it does have detectable linen, vanillin, and on the test, the shroud testing tape, the carbon-14 tape, does have detectable vanillin. So it's very suspect in that particular one. We'll get into the textiles, pollen follower image. This gets really complicated. But all of those fabrics that we'll come into just shortly will point to an origin in Jerusalem. What is the most definitive one is the pollen, not so focused on that. The pollen is the fact that pollen can be identified by species. It lasts for thousands of years. It doesn't change, doesn't decay. It's a very good way of identifying where something has been by examining the pollen, because it's very unique to that particular flower. And the fact that Max Frey that did it, it's a very specific. I won't give you all the details because it gets complicated, but just say simply saying that something like half the pollen that was found in the shroud comes from Jerusalem and not in Europe. Textiles is very difficult to identify. But the limestone dirt is also, I can show you in shortly, how that shows it's from Jerusalem, because it comes from limestone. Let's go on to where the shroud reemerged. Let's go to where the shroud, we know something about it for sure. It was exhibited for the first time publicly in 1355 by a guy named Geoffrey de Charny. We know he's the Knights Templar type. He was part of the Knights, part of the King's army too, so he lost his life 30 years later, a few years later, and in 1358. And so this is the period of time where it was risky to be a knight because of all the warfare going on. But his coat of arms here is, where is this found? It's found at the bottom of a river, actually the Seine River, by a pilgrim, apparently that lost it in 1300, so it's actually been identified very categorically to this known historical event when the shroud was being shown. And you can see the two images, the one side of it and then the reverse side of the shroud on this particular, it's called a tourist pilgrim's medallion in the museum, but it was found in the bottom of a river. So it does show, corroborate the historical fact that we know that this was shown privately in a little town called Livry in France. Let's go down and examine the shroud a little more in detail, a little scientifically. What is on the shroud, a picture in the big shroud, we found this blood stain, and some people have alleged it's just art from a painting. One of the skeptics pointed out that it must be just painted on. Well, we can identify that by many characteristics that is, in fact, blood. Very hard to simulate human blood. You can't just simply, you know, cut somebody's arm and bleed on it. It doesn't really work that way to be able to identify this as blood. And we can identify this blood as something is being their body has been suffered difficulties because the liver puts out bile and pigment, bile things. So you actually can identify what the characteristics are of the individual that did this bleeding and actually type the blood very, very carefully about the way it fluoresces under the ultraviolet, for example. Where is this formed? It's on the left side of the body between the right and 5 and 6 ribs. So it's on your right side going from right to left. So the spear would come up from the right side, it would enter and puncture the heart. The heart is kind of, people say it's on the left side, that's only because part of the apparatus is on the left side of your body, but actually it's more in the center, and so getting on the right side would be able to puncture the part that after death that would be fluid involved in it. That's why you would have blood flow after the body. Not so much blood flow, but the intercostal fluid is what it's called. So the body after death is not pumping anymore. So that's called the right auricle, which fills with blood after death, and also the pericardial fluid, which is we identified as water. Now, here's one of my favorite paintings. Who likes Caravaggio paintings? Anybody seen Caravaggio? That's one of our favorites. Like to have a little artwork in our fun time. The Incredulity of St. Thomas by Caravaggio in Potsdam, Germany. I went to see several of his artworks in my last trip to Europe. The lancia wound is on Jesus' right side in this particular case. Jesus said to him, Thomas, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen me yet have believed. And that's what I want to say to you, is that are we going to believe based on the historical record, not just simply in a shroud, which will do us no benefit whatsoever. How about the shroud ruins compared to a Roman flagrum? Roman flagrum, nobody had an idea what this was until one was excavated about Herculaneum off the coast of on the coast of Italy. About late 1700s, 1800s. And so these little dumbbells, these are reproductions, little dumbbells found, either 2 and 3 have been known to exist on a ticker, like a dumbbell type formation. A forger would have absolutely no idea that this is the case. It was just like, how can you even make this type of stuff up? But again, the skeptics don't even look at it, take it seriously. So this is the original shroud type image. Again, only in the topmost fibrils. There's another shroud image. Again, showing that there's a strap connecting it that would also impact the shroud. But it's not something that's going to be somebody able to reproduce this in any naturalistic manner. It's certainly a very great mystery. The size is roughly 2 centimeters in size, and it's precisely the right size for the what we expect the Roman flagrum to be like. It'd be like 140 strokes at 30, you know, three of these pair would be 120 with a lick, what they call a lictor on right and left side. We can see the stripes coming from two different directions. I actually showed that one of the lictors, one of the punishers, was on higher, taller than the other one. So it's a very incredibly detailed type of information that's contained on the shroud. Again, only in the tightmost fibrils. How about the crucified man's heel? Well, we know only one example in historic science of the archaeology of a nail going through a heel, actually found in one of the digs here in Jerusalem. It was by Basilus Tsaphorus. It's an ossuary. By the way, an ossuary is a place where they put the bones. In the case of the Jewish burial practices, they would put the body on a bench, let it decay for a year, and then when they take they go in and re-enter the closed tomb. Again, the tomb was like an open area, and you roll a stone in front of it, like it describes in the Bible, and you let it, it's open to the air, but closed from the outside. And then you would enter the tomb, and then you would take the bones out, left over, and you put it in your family bone box. And so that's what the process of burial according to Jerusalem techniques. So this is a right-hand bone in this case. It's called a calcineum, if you want the big name for a heel bone. It's the iron nails are pretty long. They're about 4.5 inches long, which is quite a long distance. This is his name, actually, we find on the bone box is Jehohanan ben Hagohol. And this is the tomb, Givat HaBivtar tomb site northeast of Jerusalem. So we can see what it's like, and it actually shows you like it is in the shroud buried through there. How about the burial practices here? Most people are totally confused by the artist of the day and all the simulations that somehow these people were going to carry this cross. They had no idea how heavy a cross would be composed of these woods if they could do it. But in fact, all the evidence we know is that the crucified victim was carried the patibulum, just the crossbar, and they had there are so many crucifixions being performed, they left the stipes, the upright posts set in place because they were like an assembly line in some cases of a number of crucifixions. So they would carry the patibulum on his shoulders, carry it into the place, they'd nail it to the patibulum and be raised by little hooks that would post on a pole, would be raised up into place, and then they would put the titulus, the offense list on his case of Jesus, that he said he was the King of Jews. Well, in the case, remember Pontius Pilate says, oh, I just wrote, you know, he was the King of Jews, and the Jews complained that it wasn't that he said he was. But again, that's a minor thing here. How about the newest thing that shows an enormous amount of corroboration with the shroud, which I think is very interesting? It's called the Hungarian Prey Codex, 11795. What is the characteristic that's very surprising in here? Well, if I went back to the original, which you couldn't see very well, but in the original shroud image, there are no thumbs shown on any of the fingers on the hands, which is very surprising because every other image of every artwork shows a thumb on the artwork. But in fact, that examinations by Barbet and various anatomists have shown if you penetrate the wrist, the thumb will automatically fold over even if it's dead. You know, it will type of thing. So you'll find out that there's an auto reflex causing the thumb to fold over under the body. Second thing we notice in the particular case that the hand is on the right hand over the left. We can see there's a herringbone type pattern on the fabric that's the shroud here. We don't see it in this particular image. We'll see it in the next one what has more characteristics related to it. So let's see the next one here. We have the, so here's all the characteristics. There are something like 11 characteristics that are found in the Hungarian Prey Codex that correspond to the shroud. The shroud is, in this particular case, is twice the length of the man. It's a herringbone weave pattern, which I just showed you. The L-shaped pattern of holes front and back, I'll show you that in a minute. It has beard and long hair. Some people have argued against the fact it shouldn't have any beard or long hair, so we'll discuss that if you want. The body was naked. Against all the artwork of the day, would never show a naked person, especially over the private areas, just as the hands. Mark above the right eye corresponding to a reverse three-shaped bloodstain in the shroud. Again, I have to show you a picture of that to understand that. Right hand to left, I already told you that. long fingers. That's one of the skeptics that pointed that out. It's a good argument against the shroud being genuine, is that the fingers, if it's a photograph, the fingers are too long. It's like, how'd this happen? Some have argued that, in fact, that the reason it's, the fingers appear to be long is because the image is like an X-ray. It's showing more the bones than it is the body itself. But I have a hard time buying that argument. But it does show that there's a corroboration between the Hungarian Praetor Codex and the shroud. The nail wound on the right wrist, against all artwork of the day, wrist, the puncture mark was always in the palm. No thumbs, like I just said, and three nails are used for crucifixion. Well, that's... Now let's look at the little details, seeing the object of the, and the picture of the Praetor Codex. The, again, we don't have all the details in particular, but we have just one of the blood stains related to the shroud. Particularly, this is the original. Not as quite as much detail as in the shroud itself. It's called an epsilon blood stain mark of the shroud. And we can see here more on the details, so just to show you a little bit that the, again, there's other artwork of the day. I'm not going to show you it all, but it shows you these marks that are very similar to artwork that were predated the supposed origin of the shroud. And predated to as long as we have artist pictures all the way back to the 7th century. One picture, if anybody been to the one in Mount Catherine and near Mount Sinai, there's a beautiful picture there of the Pancreator, and I could again get into that some other time or look online. But here's the detail one here of the hands, the right hand over the list, the inset in the particular case here, saying that the image, this is showing here in this particular one here, it shows the image on the wrist area, same here down here. So it's a very detailed analysis of corroboration. Look at the pictures here, the blood stain there, and the blood stain there. Here's a close-up over here in particular. Again, just seeing the entombment of the Joseph Cephas and Joseph Arimathea and Mary there in the background. And a close-up of the shroud itself. This is what I would call your attention to. This is one of the most, I'll have a close-up of this one, is that the three, the hoels, they'll make a little L pattern in here, inverse L, upside down, is this pattern of this herringbone-type pattern is actually corroborates with the poker holes, we call in the shroud. Somebody actually, they call it test by fire. Somebody had punctured the shroud to see if it survived, I guess. I don't know why they would do that, but certainly that somebody did that. And then they got these holes that correspond to the shroud. Here's the actual image of the two. The corroboration is actually astonishing. Not only the level of detail of the three holes and then one to the side, but also the location on the shroud as well. So the location, the pattern of location is very to the center, near the center, is very indicative. Now let's go into the biblical reasons here for the shroud. What is the biblical corroborations? Has anybody noticed the fact that I've noticed the fact is there's almost no support for any shroud investigation, let alone proclamation of genuineness by any Bible scholar. It's like don't touch it, don't even mention it, don't discuss it. And then one of the first ones to actually discuss it at all was one of my mentors that was named Josh McDowell. I was reading his book before I became a Christian. And I was reading his book on the answers, and he disparaged the shroud based on the fact it wasn't biblical. And that's the only time I've ever heard it mentioned, even to this date, not even discussed. So where does it come from? One of the reasons it comes from is the indication when you read the book of John chapter 11, it says that Lazarus was bound hand and foot. And it sounds the image that Jesus, the way people's image, especially by an artwork, is he was bound kind of like a mummy. And here's a painting that explains that from called The Raising of Lazarus by a painter named Lucio di Duma Menensega. This is an unbiblical idea. Why is it unbiblical? The answer is because John 11:38 says, Jesus again, groaning in himself, came to the tomb. It was a cave and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, take away the stone. Jesus cried with a loud voice, Lazarus come forth. And he who died came out, bound, that is the word, Greek word deo, hand and foot with linen strips, Greek word kaira, and his face was wrapped, perideo, with a small cloth called sardirion, and Jesus said to him, loose him and let him go. Well, wait a minute. What does this indicate? It indicates that they put and we know this from other tombs found in the time, is they would tie a hand, a little wrapping of around the wrist to hold them together, and they would tie the jaw closed to hold the jaw together, and they would tie the wrist together so that they wouldn't flop around so they could carry the body, but they weren't buried like a mummy. The proof of that is very easy. If Lazarus was walking forth like a mummy, he must have been he must have been hopping. He wasn't walking like a mummy. So the point is that it's a little silly to say that an objection that Lazarus shows that the burial practices were buried by wrapping heart around each other. In fact, they were laid in a tomb. In the case of we'll see in the burial practices of what's called violent deaths, which I just discovered this last week for sure. I'm really got original sources. Is when it's a violent death, they're actually not undressed. They're not undressed at all. Well, Jesus is already naked because of the way they're crucified, but they leave them where they are with all the blood. When they're washed the body, it's only if there's no violent death. Isn't that amazing? I just didn't realize that was the case. That when it's a violent death, they leave the body like it is. They no washing the body. They can leave, put spices on it, but they don't wash the body. That's an amazing discovery from history. The inferences, he was not a mummy, not buried like a mummy. Lazarus' hands are held by a cloth, probably across his groin and pelvic area, like shown in the shroud. Lazarus' feet were held together by a cloth. Lazarus hobbled, so he's not tightly bound. His face and jaw was bound shut by cloth below the jaw around the sides to the pate. Pate is the top of the head. All these match the man in the shroud. In fact, one of the interesting skeptics, when you read Joe McNichol and the other ones, one of the interesting ones, skeptics, was if this is genuine, why do we show the face with the hair? Because the hair should have flopped down below the head. Really good, really good objection. Well, the interesting thing about it, when you think about it, is if there's a cloth around the head, which you can actually see on the shroud, is that the face would be bound this around the head and the hair would be over the top of the cloth that holds the jaw together. So actually the objection is one of the strongest arguments in favor of the shroud. What is the fabric linen in the shroud like? It's very similar to known herringbone reeves from Egypt 1,000 years before Christ. It's not like it's unknown. It's a very expensive weave. It's not something that you could find in everyday stores, but certainly we've shown even more recently that there are 3-in-1 herringbone weaves from that period of time, even though we don't have a lot of examples from the time of Jesus, because it's such an expensive weave, you aren't going to find it in everyday tombs. So it's not going to be found that easily. We do know, like I say, it's in Egypt and other places in the Mideast, 1,000 years before Christ. But the most interesting thing that I pointed out to you before, I'll point it out again, it was so unknown in Europe in the 13th, 14th century, that if a forger had found a 3-in-1 herringbone cloth, he would have paid a fortune for it because it was almost unknown. When they went to carbon date the shroud, they couldn't find any examples of how exactly one expensive example of a 3-in-1 herringbone weave. It would have been very hard to find such a thing in the 13th, 14th century. Second thing is that the shroud, which is, how long is the shroud? Well, I don't see this in many references, Wendy, but I did the calculations and verified it. The fact is that it's accidentally, if you want to put it that way, exactly 2 cubits by 8 cubits from the Assyrian fabric store. That's the way they would have sold it, by fabrics or half fabric and half cubits. But it wouldn't be this type of centimeters, because remember, the centimeters didn't exist in the time of Jesus or in the other times. And why would it be that particular dimensions anyway? Even if it was in Europe, there's no indication why that particular size should have been found. In fact, there's a side strip found on it too that's not to make it a little wider. So this is documented from Wendell Flinders Petrie, starting in 1877, how long the fabrics should have been. The curious. By the way, in case you're unaware of it, is that the technical definition for a cubit is from your elbow to the front, your point of your hand. But again, everybody's got a different size. So the standard was like 21.6 inches, about the average. And it becomes a constant during that period of time. But these type of things would be unknown to a forger. What about the fabric that identified for the Mideast? What about the plain weaves? Well, the plain weaves, like I said before, again, I'll say it, is that the first century shrouds found in the burials we do have are by by poor people. I mean, like, you're not going to find 3-in-1 herringbone weaves. It's not going to be very common. But we do find some examples of examples. This one was Alcaldema by Orit Shamir. What is it like? The reason why this I bring up this example is because they find the stitching on it matches the shroud, not the fabric itself, or it's not the 3-in-1 herringbone twill, but they found out that the stitching on these shrouds were matched the one. Where it's found in particular that matched the stitching was from Masada, the matched the stitches, and that's what I didn't point. I have a slide on that, but that was a discovery very recently by a textile expert. The fact is, we know the stitching that was found in the shroud is not done in Egypt, in Europe, during the 13th century. There's no examples of that type of stitching. So it points very definitively that it's not a fraud from the European fraud of that period of time. Of course, the skeptics can say, well, they got an old piece of cloth and from the first century, and they brought it over to Europe. Well, that, you can believe that if you want. What is the fabric like? Here's another interesting part about it. The linen that was found here was bleached separately. Well, who would ever think of this? During the 13th century, all the fabric that's found is you put the fabric together and you dye it as one cloth. But in the shroud, and in particular the first century, you don't do that. You take each piece of the fabric, you dye it, and then you put the fabric together. That's because of the techniques. They didn't have mass production back in the first century. That's the way you make the shroud. In fact, the shroud does show that characteristic. It has these variations in color, very subtle in the original, not the image, just the fabric itself, has these variations in color from the flax. The Roman period linen, each yarn was bleached separately. You know, when I say you got a bowl of yarn, how do you make it in the first century? You weave it together. You don't have a big machine to put it together. You have to take each yarn to put it together. You dye each batch of yarn, and lo and behold, it shows color variation patterns. But the medieval linen was bleached after the cloth was made. We know that for a high confidence fact. We see every example is shown that way. Medieval linen was bleached after the cloth was made. Then they dye it to get to color after that period of time. So you may not see the bleaching because, of course, the color will disguise the original. Of course, the shroud is not dyed in that case. But the shroud of Turin shows color patterns, and the inference from this characteristic alone is that the Turin shroud is not medieval. How about some fun pictures here in a particular case? Here's some flax flowers. This is what flax is made of. Flax is made of different things than cotton. The cotton is a type of fiber that's found from the Linum usitatasium. If I can pronounce it, the flax flowers. It makes a really pretty picture, but of course the flax is made from the plant itself, not from the flowers. How about the going back to the sewing of what we call the connections, where they sew the stitching together. Mess Child Fleury Lemberg was a textile expert that did the research on Masada I mentioned before. But again, this is the fabric on the shroud. Type with selvage of the stitching of the seam is visible only its reverse. The non-image side is the same as first century Jewish textiles found at Masada, and the unique stitching is found nowhere else. It's a direct quote. High and low density yarn bleaching bands on the shroud and other fabrics from the Roman period, not from medieval fabric. You can actually see it in this picture if you could see the banding. You see the banding a little bit? It's hard to see. It's highly contrast the image here, but the banding does occur. You can see the left a little bit lighter than the middle, a little bit lighter than the down. You can see various bands of color, of white in it, versus light, that period of time. What is a herringbone weave? Any weavers among here or sewers? Here's your education for the day. What's a warp and a weft? Warp is the long dimension, and weft is where you cross the fibers. So you're going to put a 3-in-1, it's going to take your long dimension will go 3/3 of the weft sides, and then you go back and skip more 3. So it's a very unnecessarily complex characteristics. It doesn't it takes you a lot longer to make for no real benefit. This one over here is just 1-on-1, so there's the 2 over here. So this one is a little bit different characteristic. So this is over and under, over and under. So this is a basic pattern. This is the complicated 3-in-1 herringbone weave. It'll make this herringbone. Why does it show a herringbone? Is because we reverse it at a period of time and shows you that just for artist meaning. Here's another pretty picture, but it's very relevant. It's called the Cardus argentatus. Grows around Jerusalem and flowers in April and May. That's why it's significant, is because the pollen of this plant is found in the shroud among many other plants. I showed this about 50 different varieties form the detailed notes. If you look online, you'll find the examples of pollen found in the shroud. Over half of the pollen, in fact, one of the plants in particular is from a large number of it's from the Jerusalem area only. And the flower image that appear in the shroud, I'm not going to use as arguments because it's so debated. And same with the coin images. They're so faint against the thought fibrils. Is it really real? Again, you have to use your imagination to certain. And I'm going to use that as an argument. Just for the pollen is no definitive, and so I'll look to that. How about the last argument that's really data here related to it? By some astonishing characteristic, somebody noticed that, in fact, that there's dirt on the heel area of this shroud. And when they're examining it with 60 tape samples, and they examine it carefully, and they get what's called gas chromatograph test on it to find out what chemicals are in it. Well, I'll spare you the chemicals, but I'll just point it out. The answer is it's identical characteristic to a travertine aragonite limestone found on the heel. It's found on an area of limestone only from the Jerusalem area. It's not found very rare anywhere else in the world. So it's very rare that we'd be able to find this element. And why would a forger put a piece of dirt on it that just happened to be in that area, even if he knew where it was coming from? It certainly seems to be lies the imagination. What is in this piece of dirt? Again, this is not one piece of dirt. There's quite a bit of it. It's not just one little fabric of dirt. This dirt found on the heel has been identified as travertine aragonite. What is it? It has a similar signature, strikingly similar to limestone from ancient Jerusalem tombs. What is the characteristic? It's called strontium and iron. Those are the two characteristics that are unusually matched. This is considered so significant, it was published in a Biblical Archaeology Review of July of 1986 by Cole, Beck, and Natowski, for those who are just listening to audio. What are my conclusions? My conclusions based on this that's so significant is that I am glad that the shroud failed the radiocarbon test. Why is that? Why should I be glad that it failed? Even though I was sad for 20 years, until we came with more evidence related to it. But because the shroud is an unprovenance artifact, it should not be trustingly believed. One of the problems we have with belief today is we understand that I'm going to believe I'm going to have a cup of coffee is the same I'm going to believe in the Bible. It's not the same thing of word for belief. In Greek, word pisteo means that you trustingly believe in something. I don't want a trustingly belief in the shroud. It certainly does me no benefit to believe that. And so I consider that as just something in an artifact to be examined. It's something we can learn from, perhaps, as we did. The only benefit from belief is from Romans 12, 9 and 10. If you confess with your mouth the Lord Jesus and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you'll be saved. For with the heart one believes unto righteousness, and with the mouth confesses is made unto salvation. So it's the one mark for belief that gives you an understanding what it means where I come from as far as the shroud is concerned, and what we need to believe as far as the Bible is reliable. It's what we do with it that matters. The arguments from the summary, I can give you some references here too, but again, I use my main argument from the skeptic, and I'll come back to that as we talk about the summary. What is the main argument for the Joe Nickel and the variety of skeptics? Their argument is the fact is that carbon-14 dating was considered to be reliable, and they're going to take that as a proof positive of being a fraud, middle-aged fraud, without looking at any of the data. I'm a mathematician. You examine all the data and how it fits best fits. I said to a skeptic, I said, you know about the Bible? He says, we agree on two things. Either the Bible is either totally reliable or it's totally worthless, you know? We can agree that they have that option. But these skeptics will look at that carbon-14 dating, but they also say that, I don't think I mentioned it briefly, it's in the notes, that there was a bishop of D'Arcy that said that he had seen known about the forger. He heard about the forger, and that this one fake was, in this province, little province, they had a shroud. It was obviously fake. Well, how could it possibly be genuine? I'm looking at it from his standpoint. How could it possibly be genuine? Because after all, it would take a king's ransom to get any of the artifact, any type of relic. So obviously, some poor knight isn't going to have a genuine shroud in any case. So I can see his viewpoint, but he never went to look to see. But Darcy said that he knew that there was, it was, the artist had said it was a fraud, and he quoted this in fact, that as if this testimony was valid. Well, if the Bishop Darcy had never seen the shroud, how is he going to make a judgment on that? That's simply not fair. It's an unfair accusation. And second of all, is the fact is that no one has to this date. In fact, the Roman Catholic Church does not treat it as a relic. Strange, they got lots of relics around. It's one of the ones exceptions, not a relic. It's called a representation. So again, that comes to tradition from the 13th century that they were going to call it a representation, which I think is fine. The artist fraud characteristic says, well, even Joe Nichol has come to the viewpoint. He says, yeah, it's pretty hard to make an artist generation. I'm going to find a way of doing it. So he had a lot of experiments, and other skeptics have done it, take dead bodies and try to get an image out of it. And they've done a reasonable job, but nothing like the technical qualities. In fact, the best thing they've come up with is saying, well, during the 13th, they get this as a true quote, okay? During the 13th century, they had a real crucified guy, and he was really crucified, and they covered him over, and a vapor came up and colored this fabric. Like the level of detail here is just boggles the mind, but that's the best they can come up with. The only thing we can agree is that artists probably couldn't do this. You know, it's just beyond comprehension how they could art. But they don't even look at the different characteristics I told you about. The blood, they call the blood just painting. They don't look at the crucifixion characteristics, the first century fabric. Again, if you don't look at all the evidence, how can you come up with a conclusion? And in fact, Joe Nichols is about one of the few skeptics that's left, basically. The rest of them won't even touch it. He generally believes that it's a fake, and I can understand that from his skeptical viewpoint. But he certainly doesn't look at all the evidence related to it. I think that we'll close here a little early here so we can have more time for questions. And so I appreciate you coming here.